I didn't want to be like Zia. On the other hand, I realized for the first time just how much courage she must have had to stand up to a goddess while protecting two complete novices. I hate to say it, but it gave me a newfound respect for her. I wished I had her bravery. I raised my staff and wand and tried to focus. Time seemed to slow down. I reached out with my senses until I was aware of everything around me. Emma scrawling with chalk to finish the circle, Lizzie's heart beating too fast, Bobby's massive feet pounding on the bridge as he ran toward us, the Thames flowing under the bridge, and the currents of the Duat flowing around me just as powerfully. Bast once told me the Duat was like an ocean of magic under the surface of the mortal world. If that was true, then this place, a bridge over moving water, was like a jet stream. Magic flowed more strongly here. It could drown the unwary. Even gods might be swept away. I tried to anchor myself by concentrating on the landscape around me. London was my city. From here I could see everything. The Houses of Parliament, the London Eye, even Cleopatra's Needle on the Victoria Embankment, where my mother had died. If I failed now, so close to where my mother had worked her last magic. No, I couldn't let it come to that. Bobby was only a meter away when Emma finished the circle. I touched my staff to the chalk and golden light flared up. The baboon god slammed into my protective force field like it was a metal wall. He staggered backward. Nekbet swerved away at the last second and flew around us, cawing in frustration. Unfortunately, the circle's light began to flicker. My mum had taught me at a very young age, for every action there is an equal and opposite reaction. That applied to magic as well as science. The force of Bobby's assault left me seeing black spots. If he attacked again, I wasn't sure I could hold the circle. I wondered if I should step outside it, make myself the target. If I channeled energy into the circle first, it might maintain itself for a while, even if I died. At least my friends would live. Zia Rashid had probably been thinking the same thing last Christmas when she stepped outside her circle to protect Carter and me. She really had been annoyingly brave. "Whatever happens to me," I told my friends, "stay inside the circle." "Sadie," Emma said, "I know that tone of voice. Whatever you're planning, don't—" "You can't leave us," Liz pleaded. Then she shouted at Bobby in a squeaky voice, "Go away, you horrible foamy ape! My friend here doesn't want to destroy you, but she will!" Bobby snarled. He was rather foamy, thanks to the body shop attack, and he smelled wonderful. Several different colours of shampoo foam and bath beads were matted in his silver fur. Nekbet hadn't fared so well. She perched atop a nearby lamppost, looking as if she'd been assaulted by the entire contents of the West Cornwall Pasty Company. Bits of ham, cheese and potatoes splattered her feathery cloak, giving testament to the brave enchanted meat pies that had given their brief lives to delay her. Her hair was decorated with plastic forks, napkins and bits of pink newsprint. She looked quite keen to tear me to shreds. The only good news? Bobby's minions evidently hadn't made it out of the train station. I imagined a troop of pasty-splattered baboons shoved against police cars and handcuffed. It lifted my spirits somewhat. Nekbet snarled.
"You surprised us at the station, Sadie Kane. I'll admit that was well done, and bringing us to this bridge. A good try, but we are not so weak. You don't have the strength to fight us any longer. If you cannot defeat us, you have no business raising Ra."
"You lot should be helping me," I said, "not trying to stop me."
"Ugh!"
Bobby barked.
"Indeed," agreed the vulture goddess. "The strong survive without help. The weak must be killed and eaten. Which are you, child? Be honest."
The truth? I was about to drop. The bridge seemed to be spinning beneath me. Sirens wailed on both banks of the river. More police had arrived at the barricades, but for now they made no effort to advance. Bobby bared his fangs. He was so close I could smell his shampooed fur and his horrid breath. Then I looked at Gramps' glasses still stuck on his head, and all my anger came back. "Try me," I said. "I follow the path of Isis. Cross me and I'll destroy you." I managed to light my staff. Bobby stepped back. Nekbet fluttered on her lamppost. Their forms shimmered briefly. The river was weakening them, loosening their connection to the mortal world like interference on a mobile phone line. But it wasn't enough. Nekbet must have seen the desperation in my face. She was a vulture. She specialized in knowing when her prey was finished.
"A good last effort, child," she said, almost with appreciation. "But you have nothing left. Bobby, attack!"
The baboon god reared up on his back legs. I got ready to charge and deliver one final burst of energy to tap into my own life source and hopefully vaporize the gods. I had to make sure Liz and Emma survived. Then the limo's door opened behind me. Bess announced,
"No one is attacking anyone, except me, of course."
Nekbet shrieked in alarm. I turned to see what was going on. Immediately, I wished I could burn my eyes out of my head. Liz made a gagging sound.
"Lord, no! That's wrong! Ugh!"
Emma shouted in perfect baboon speak.
"Make him stop!"
Bess had indeed put on his ugly outfit. He climbed onto the roof of the limo and stood there, legs planted, arms akimbo, like Superman, except with only the underwear. For those faint of heart, I won't go into great detail, but Bess, all of a meter tall, was showing off his disgusting physique. His pot belly, hairy limbs, awful feet, gross flabby bits, and wearing only a blue Speedo. Imagine the worst-looking person you've ever seen on a public beach, the person for whom swimwear should be illegal. Bess looked worse than that. I wasn't sure what to say except,
"Put on some clothes!"
Bess laughed, the sort of guffaw that says,
"Ha ha, I'm amazing!" "Not until they leave," he said, "or I'll be forced to scare them back to the Duat."
"This is not your affair, dwarf god!"
Nekbet snarled, averting her eyes from his horribleness.
"Go away!"
"These children are under my protection," Bess insisted.
"I don't know you," I said. "I never met you before today."
"Nonsense. You expressly asked for my protection."
"I didn't ask for the Speedo Patrol." Bess leaped off the limo and landed in front of my circle, placing himself between Bobby and me. The dwarf was even more horrible from behind. His back was so hairy it looked like a mink coat. And on the back of his Speedo was printed Dwarf Pride. Bess and Bobby circled each other like wrestlers. The baboon god swiped at Bess, but the dwarf was agile. He scrambled up Bobby's chest and headbutted him in the nose. Bobby staggered backward as the dwarf continued pounding away, using his face as a deadly weapon.
"Don't hurt him," I yelled. "It's my Gramps in there."
Bobby slumped against the railing. He blinked, trying to regain his bearings, but Bess breathed on him, and the smell of curry must have been too much. The baboon's knees buckled. His body shimmered and began to shrink. He crumpled on the pavement and melted into a stocky, grey-haired pensioner in a tattered cardigan.
"Cramps!"
I couldn't stand it. I left the protective circle and ran to his side.
"He'll be fine," Bess promised.
Then he turned toward the vulture goddess.
"Now it's your turn, Nekbet. Leave!"
"I stole this body fair and square," she wailed. "I like it in here."
"You asked for it."
Bess rubbed his hands, took a deep breath, and did something I will never be able to erase from my memory. If I simply said he made a face and yelled boo, that would be technically correct, but it wouldn't begin to convey the horror. His head swelled, his jaw unhinged until his mouth was four times too big, his eyes bulged like grapefruits, his hair stuck straight up like Bast's, he shook his face and waggled his slimy green tongue and roared, "Boo!" So loudly the sound rolled across the Thames like a cannon shot. This blast of pure ugly blew the feathers off Nekbet's cloak and drained all the colour from her face. It ripped away the essence of the goddess like tissue paper in a storm. The only thing left was a dazed old woman in a flower print dress squatting on the lamppost. "Oh, dear," Gran fainted. Bess jumped up and caught her before she could topple into the river. The dwarf's face went back to normal, well, normally ugly, at least, as he eased Gran onto the pavement next to Gramps. "Thank you," I told Bess. "Now will you please put on some clothes?" He gave me a toothy grin, which I could have lived without.
"You're all right, Sadie Kane. I see why Bast likes you."
"Sadie?"
my grandfather groaned, his eyelids fluttering open. "I'm here, Gramps," I stroked his forehead. "How do you feel?"
"Strange craving for mangoes,"
he went cross-eyed.
"And possibly insects. You saved us?"
"Not really," I admitted. "My friend here..."
"Certainly she saved you,"
Bess said.
"Brave girl you have here. Quite a magician."
Gramps focused on Bess and scowled.
"Bloody Egyptian gods in their bloody revealing swimwear. This is why we don't do magic."
I sighed with relief. Once Gramps started complaining, I knew he was going to be all right. Gran was still passed out, but her breathing seemed steady. The colour was coming back into her cheeks.
"We should go," Bess said. "The mortals are ready to storm the bridge."
I glanced toward the barricades and saw what he meant. An assault team was gathering, heavily armoured men with rifles, grenade launchers, and probably many other fun toys that could kill us. "Liz, Emma," I called, "help me with my grandparents." My friends ran over and started to help Gramps sit up, but Bess said,
"They can't come."
"What?" I demanded. "But you just said..."
"They're mortals," Bess said. "They don't belong on your quest. If we're going to get the second scroll from Vlad Menshikov, we need to leave now."
"You know about that?" Then I remembered he'd spoken with Anubis.
"Your grandparents and friends are in less danger here," Bess said. "The police will question them, but they won't see old people and children as a threat."
"We're not children,"
Emma grumbled.
"Vultures," Gran whispered in her sleep. "Meat pies."
Gramps coughed.
"The dwarf is right, Sadie. Go. I'll be tip-top in a moment, though it's a pity that baboon chap couldn't leave me some of his power. I haven't felt that strong in ages."
I looked at my bedraggled grandparents and friends. My heart felt it was being stretched in more directions than Bessie's face. I realized the dwarf was right. They'd be safer here facing an assault team than going with us. And I realized, too, that they didn't belong on a magic quest. My grandparents had chosen long ago not to use their ancestral abilities, and my friends were just mortals. Brave, mad, ridiculous, wonderful mortals. But they couldn't go where I had to go.
"Sadie, it's fine."
Emma adjusted her broken glasses and tried for a smile. "We can handle the police. Won't be the first time we've had to do some quick talking, eh?"
"We'll take care of your gran and gramps," Liz promised.
"Don't need taking care of,"
Gramps complained. Then he broke down in a fit of coughing.
"Just go, my dear. That baboon god was in my head. I can tell you he means to destroy you. Finish your quest before he comes after you again. I couldn't even stop him. I couldn't..."
He looked resentfully at his shaky old hands.
"I never would have forgiven myself. Now off with you."
"I'm sorry," I told them all. "I didn't mean..."
"Sorry?" Emma demanded. "Sadie Kane, that was the most brilliant birthday party ever. Now go."
She and Liz both hugged me, and before I could start crying, Bess shepherded me into the Mercedes. We drove north toward the Victoria Embankment. We were almost to the barricades when Bess slowed down.
"What's wrong?" I asked.
Can't we go past invisibly?
It's not the mortals I'm worried about.
He pointed. All the police, reporters, and spectators around the barricades had fallen asleep. Several military types in body armor were curled on the pavement, cuddling their assault rifles like teddy bears. Standing in front of the barricades, blocking our car, were Carter and Walt. They were disheveled and breathing heavily, as if they'd run here all the way from Brooklyn. They both had wands at the ready. Carter stepped forward, pointing his sword at the windshield. "Let her go!" he yelled at Bess, "or I'll destroy you!" Bess glanced back at me.
"Should I frighten him?"
"No," I said. That was something I didn't need to see again. "I'll handle it." I stepped out of the limo. "Hello, boys. Brilliant timing." Walt and Carter frowned.
"You're not in danger?" Walt asked me.
"Not anymore."
Carter lowered his sword reluctantly. "You mean the ugly guy?"
"He's a friend," I said. "Bast's friend. He's also our driver." Carter looked equal parts confused, annoyed, and uneasy, which made a satisfying ending to my birthday party.
"Driver to where?"
he asked. "Russia, of course," I said. "Hop in."
9. We get a vertically challenged tour of Russia. As usual, Sadie left out some important details, like how Walt and I nearly killed ourselves trying to find her. It wasn't fun, flying to the Brooklyn Museum. We had to hang from a rope under the griffin's belly like a couple of Tarzans, dodging policemen, emergency workers, city officials, and several old ladies who chased after us with umbrellas, screaming, "There's the hummingbird! Kill it!" Once we managed to open a portal, I wanted to take Freak through with us, but the gate of swirling sand kind of, well, freaked him out. So we had to leave him behind. When we got to London, television monitors in the storefronts were showing footage of Waterloo Station, something about a strange disturbance inside the terminal with escaped animals and windstorms. Gee, wonder who that could have been. We used Walt's amulet for Shu the Air God to summon a burst of wind and jump to the Waterloo Bridge. Of course, we landed right in the middle of a heavily armed riot squad. Just luck that I remembered the sleep spell. Then, finally, we were ready to charge in and save Sadie, and she rides up in a limousine driven by an ugly dwarf in a swimsuit, and she accuses us of being late. So when she told us the dwarf was driving us to Russia, I was like, whatever, and I got into the car. The limousine drove through Westminster while Sadie, Walt, and I traded stories. After hearing what Sadie had been through, I didn't feel so bad about my day. A dream of Apophis and a three-headed snake in the training room didn't seem nearly as scary as gods taking over our grandparents. I'd never liked Gran and Gramps that much, but still, yikes. I also couldn't believe our chauffeur was Bess. Dad and I used to laugh about his pictures in museums, his bulging eyes, wagging tongue, and general lack of clothing. Supposedly, he could scare away almost anything. Spirits, demons, even other gods, which is why the Egyptian commoners had loved him. Bess looked out for the little guy. Which wasn't meant as a dwarf joke. In the flesh, he looked exactly like his pictures, only in full color, with full smell. "We owe you," I told him. "So you're a friend of Bast's?" His ears turned red.
"Yeah, sure. She asks me for a favor once in a while. I try to help out."
I got the feeling there was some history there he didn't want to go into. "When Horus spoke to me," I said, "he warned that some of the gods might try to stop us from waking Ra. Now I guess we know who." Sadie exhaled.
"If they didn't like our plan, an angry text message would have done. Nekbet and Bobby almost tore me apart."
Her face was a little green. Her combat boots were splattered with shampoo and mud, and her favorite leather jacket had a stain on the shoulder that looked suspiciously like vulture poop. Still, I was impressed that she was conscious. Potions are hard to make and even harder to use. There's always a price for channeling that much magic. You did great, I told her. Sadie looked resentfully at the black knife in her lap, the ceremonial blade Anubis had given her. I'd be dead if not for Bess.
Nah, Bess said. Well, okay, you probably would be. But you would have gone down in style.
Sadie turned the strange black knife as if she might find instructions written on it. It's a Nijiri, I said. A serpent blade. Priests used it for the opening of the mouth ceremony, she said.
But how does that help us?
Don't know, I admitted. Bess?
Death rituals. I try to avoid them.
I looked at Walt. Magic items were his specialty, but he didn't seem to be paying attention. Ever since Sadie had told us about her talk with Anubis, Walt had been awfully quiet. He sat next to her, fidgeting with his rings. You okay? I asked him. Yeah, just thinking. He glanced at Sadie. About Nijiri blades, I mean. Sadie tugged at her hair like she was trying to make a curtain between her and Walt. The tension between them was so thick I doubted even a magic knife could cut through it.
Bloody Anubis, she muttered. I could have died for all he cared.
We drove in silence for a while after that. Finally, Bess turned onto Westminster Bridge and doubled back over the Thames. Sadie frowned.
Where are we going? We need a portal. All the best artifacts are at the British Museum.
Yeah, Bess said. And the other magicians know that.
Other magicians? I asked.
Kid, the House of Life has branches all over the world. London is the 9th gnome. With that stunt at Waterloo, Miss Sadie just set up a big flare telling Desjardins' followers, "Here I am!" You can bet they're going to be hunting you now. They'll be covering the museum in case you make a run for it. Fortunately, I know a different place we can open a portal.
Schooled by a dwarf. It should have occurred to me that London had other magicians. The House of Life was everywhere. Outside the security of Brooklyn House, there wasn't a single continent where we'd be safe. We rode through South London. The scene along Camberwell Road was almost as depressing as my thoughts. Rows of grubby brick apartments and low-rent shops lined the street. An old woman scowled at us from a bus stop. In the doorway of an Asda grocery store, a couple of young tough guys eyed the Mercedes as if they wanted to steal it. I wondered if they were gods or magicians in disguise, because most people didn't notice the car. I couldn't imagine where Bess was taking us. It didn't seem like the kind of neighborhood where you'd find a lot of Egyptian artifacts. Finally, a big park opened up on our left. Misty green fields, tree-lined paths, and a few ruined walls like aqueducts covered in vines. The land sloped upward to a hilltop with a radio tower. Bess jumped the curb and drove straight over the grass, knocking down a sign that said, "Keep to the path." The evening was gray and rainy, so there weren't many people around. A couple of joggers on the nearby path didn't even look at us, as if they saw Mercedes limos four-wheeling across the park every day. "Where are we going?" I asked.
"Watch and learn, kid," Bess said.
Being called kid by a guy shorter than me was a little annoying, but I kept my mouth shut. Bess drove straight up the hill. Close to the top was a stone staircase, maybe 30 feet wide, built into the hillside. It seemed to lead nowhere. Bess slammed on the brakes, and we swerved to a stop. The hill was higher than I'd realized. Spread out below us was the whole of London. Then I looked more closely at the staircase. Two sphinxes made of weathered stone lay on either side of the stairs, watching over the city. Each was about 10 feet long, with the typical lion's body and pharaoh's head, but they seemed totally out of place in a London park. "Those aren't real," I said. Bess snorted.
"Of course they're real."
"I mean, they aren't from ancient Egypt. They're not old enough."
"Picky, picky," Bess said. These are the stairs to the Crystal Palace. Big glass and steel exhibit hall the size of a cathedral used to sit right here on this hill.
Sadie frowned. I read about that in school. Queen Victoria had a party there, something.
A party or something?
Bess grunted.
It was the Grand Exhibition in 1851. Showcase of British Imperial Might, etc. They had good candied apples.
You were there? I asked. Bess shrugged.
The palace burned down in the 1930s, thanks to some stupid magicians, but that's another story. All that's left now are a few relics like these stairs and the sphinxes.
A stairway to nowhere, I said.
Not nowhere,
Bess corrected.
Tonight, it'll take us to St. Petersburg.
Waltz sat forward. His interest in the statues had apparently shaken him out of his gloom.
But if the sphinxes aren't really Egyptian, he said, how can they open a portal?
Bess gave him a toothy grin.
Depends on what you mean by really Egyptian, kid. Every great empire is a wannabe Egypt. Having Egyptian stuff around makes them feel important. That's why you've got new Egyptian artifacts in Rome, Paris, London, you name it. That obelisk in Washington.
Don't mention that one, please, Sadie said.
Anyway,
Bess continued,
these are still Egyptian sphinxes. They were built to play up the connection between the British Empire and the Egyptian Empire. So yeah, they can channel magic, especially if I'm driving. And now,
he looked at Walt,
it's probably time for you to get out.
I was too surprised to say anything, but Walt stared at his lap as if he'd been expecting this.
Hang on, Sadie said. Why can't Walt come with us? He's a magician. He can help.
Bess's expression turned serious.
Walt, you haven't told them.
Told us what?
Sadie demanded. Walt clutched his amulets as if there might be one that would help him avoid this conversation.
It's nothing, really. It's just, I should help out at Brooklyn House. And Jazz thought,
he faltered, probably realizing that he shouldn't have brought up her name.
Yes.
Sadie's tone was dangerously calm.
How's Jazz doing?
She's still in a coma, Walt said. Amos says she'll probably make it, but that's not what I...
Good, Sadie said. Glad she'll get better. So you need to get back, then. That's brilliant. Off you go. Anubis said we should hurry.
Not very subtle, the way she threw his name out there. Walt looked like she'd kicked him in the chest. I knew Sadie wasn't being fair to him. From my conversation with Walt back at Brooklyn House, I knew he liked Sadie. Whatever was bothering him, it wasn't any kind of romantic thing with Jazz. On the other hand, if I tried to take his side, Sadie would just tell me to butt out. I might even make things worse between Sadie and him.
It's not that I want to go back, he managed.
But you can't go with us,
Bess said firmly. I thought I heard concern in his voice, even pity.
Go on, kid. It's fine.
Walt fished something out of his pocket.
Sadie, about your birthday, you, probably don't want any more presents. It's not a magic knife, but I made this for you.
He poured a gold necklace into her hand. It had a small Egyptian symbol. That's the basketball hoop on Ra's head, I said. Walt and Sadie both frowned at me, and I realized I probably wasn't making the moment more magical for them. I mean, it's the symbol that surrounds Ra's sun crown, I said. A never-ending loop, the symbol of eternity, right? Sadie swallowed as if the magic potion was still bubbling in her stomach.
Eternity.
Walt shot me a look that clearly meant, please stop helping.
Yeah, he said. It's called Shen. I just thought, you know, you're looking for Ra, And good things, important things, should be eternal. So maybe it'll bring you luck. I meant to give it to you this morning, but I kind of lost my nerve.
Sadie stared at the talisman glittering in her palm.
Walt, thank you, but...
Just remember, I didn't want to leave, he said. If you need help, I'll be there for you. He glanced at me and corrected himself.
I mean both of you, of course.
But now, Bess said, you need to go.
Happy birthday, Sadie, Walt said, and good luck. He got out of the car and trudged down the hill. We watched until he was just a tiny figure in the gloom. Then he vanished into the woods.
Two farewell gifts, Sadie muttered, from two gorgeous guys. I hate my life.
She latched the gold necklace around her throat and touched the Shen symbol. Bess gazed down at the trees where Walt had disappeared.
Poor kid. Born unusual, all right. It isn't fair.
What do you mean? I asked. Why are you so anxious for Walt to leave? The dwarf rubbed his scraggly beard.
Not my place to explain. Right now we've got work to do. The more time we give Menshikov to prepare his defenses, the harder this is going to get.
I wasn't ready to drop it, but Bess stared at me stubbornly, and I knew I wasn't going to get any more answers from him. Nobody can look stubborn like a dwarf. So, Russia, I said, by driving up an empty staircase.
Exactly.
Bess floored the accelerator. The Mercedes churned grass and mud and barreled up the stairs. I was sure we'd reach the top and get nothing but a broken axle, but at the last second, a portal of swirling sand opened in front of us. Our wheels left the ground, and the black limousine flew headlong into the vortex. We slammed into pavement on the other side, scattering a group of surprised teenagers. Sadie groaned and pried her head off the headrest.
"Can't we go anywhere gently?" she asked.
Bess hit the wipers and scraped the sand off our windshield. Outside, it was dark and snowy. 18th-century stone buildings lined a frozen river lit with street lamps. Beyond the river glowed more fairy tale buildings, golden church domes, white palaces, and ornate mansions painted Easter egg green and blue. I might have believed we'd traveled back in time 300 years, except for the cars, the electric lights, and of course the teenagers with body piercings, dyed hair, and black leather clothes, screaming at us in Russian and pounding on the hood of the Mercedes because we'd almost run them over.
They can see us? Sadie asked.
Russians, Bess said with a kind of grudging admiration. Very superstitious people. They tend to see magic for what it is. We'll have to be careful here.
You've been here before? I asked. He gave me a duh look, then pointed to either side of the car. We'd landed between two stone sphinxes standing on pedestals. They looked like a lot of sphinxes I'd seen, with crowned human heads on lion bodies, but I'd never seen sphinxes covered in snow.
Are those authentic? I asked.
Farthest north Egyptian artifacts in the world, Bess said. Pillaged from Thebes and brought up here to decorate Russia's new imperial city, St. Petersburg. Like I said, every new empire wants a piece of Egypt.
The kids outside were still shouting and banging on the car. One smashed a bottle against our windshield.
Sadie said, should we move?
Nah, Bess said. Russian kids always hang out by the sphinxes. Been doing it for hundreds of years.
But it's like midnight here, I said, and it's snowing.
Did I mention they're Russian? Bess said. Don't worry, I'll take care of it.
He opened his door. Glacier-cold wind swept into the Mercedes, but Bess stepped out wearing nothing but his Speedo. The kids backed up quickly. I couldn't blame them. Bess said something in Russian, then roared like a lion. The kids screamed and ran. Bess's form seemed to ripple. When he got back into the car, he was wearing a warm winter coat, a fur-lined hat, and fuzzy mittens.
"See?" he said. "Superstitious. They know enough to run from a god."
"A small, hairy god in a Speedo, yes," Sadie said. "So what do we do now?"
Bess pointed across the river at a glowing palace of white and gold stone.
"That's the Hermitage."
"Hermits live there?" Sadie asked.
"No," I said. "I've heard of that place. It was the Tsar's palace. Now it's a museum. Best Egyptian collection in Russia."
"Dad took you there, I suppose?" Sadie asked.
I thought we were over the whole jealous about traveling the world with Dad thing, but every once in a while it cropped up again. "We never went." I tried not to sound defensive. "He got an invitation to speak there once, but he declined." Bess chuckled.
"Your dad was smart. Russian magicians don't exactly welcome outsiders. They protect their territory fiercely."
Sadie stared across the river.
"You mean the headquarters of the 18th Nome is inside the museum?"
"Somewhere," Bess agreed. "But it's hidden with magic, because I've never found the entrance. That part you're looking at is the Winter Palace, the old home of the Tsar. There's a whole complex of other mansions behind it. I've heard it would take 11 days just to see everything in all the Hermitage collections."
"But unless we wake Ra, the world ends in 4 days, I said.
3 days now, Sadie corrected, if it's after midnight.
I winced. Thanks for the reminder.
"So take the abbreviated tour," Bess said. "Start with the Egyptian section. Ground floor, main museum."
"Aren't you coming with us?" I asked.
"He can't, can he?" Sadie guessed. "Like Bast couldn't enter Desjardins' house in Paris. The magicians charm their headquarters against the gods. Isn't that right?"
Bess made an even uglier face.
"I'll walk you down to the bridge, but I can't go any farther. If I cross the river Neva too close to the Hermitage, I'll set off all kinds of alarms. You'll have to sneak inside somehow."
"Breaking into a museum at night," Sadie muttered. "We've had such good luck with that."
"And find the entrance to the 18th Nome, and don't get captured alive."
"What do you mean?" I asked. "It's better to be captured dead?" The look in his eyes was grim.
"Just trust me. You don't want to be Menshikov's prisoner."
Bess snapped his fingers, and suddenly we were wearing fleece parkas, ski pants, and winter boots.
"Come on, Malishi," he said. "I'll walk you to the Dvortsovoye Bridge."
The bridge was only a few hundred yards away, but it seemed farther. March obviously wasn't springtime in St. Petersburg. The dark, the wind, and the snow made it feel more like January in Alaska. Personally, I would have preferred a sweltering day in the Egyptian desert. Even with the warm clothes Bess had summoned for us, my teeth couldn't stop chattering. Bess wasn't in a hurry. He kept slowing down and giving us the guided tour until I thought my nose would fall off from frostbite. He told us we were on Vasilyevsky Island, across the Neva River from the center of St. Petersburg. He pointed out the different church spires and monuments, and when he got excited, he started slipping into Russian.
"You spent a lot of time here," I said.
He walked in silence for a few paces.
"Most of that was long ago. It wasn't..."
He stopped so abruptly, I stumbled into him. He stared across the street at a big palace with canary yellow walls and a green gabled roof. Lit up in the night through a swirl of snow, it looked unreal, like one of the ghostly images in the first gnome's Hall of Ages.
"Prince Menshikov's palace,"
Bess muttered. His voice was full of loathing. I almost thought he was going to yell boo at the building, but he just gritted his teeth. Sadie looked at me for an explanation, but I wasn't a walking Wikipedia like she seemed to think. I knew stuff about Egypt, but Russia? Not so much.
"You mean Menshikov, as in Vlad the Inhaler?" I asked.
"He's a descendant."
Bess curled his lip with distaste. He said a Russian word I was willing to bet was a pretty bad insult.
Back in the 1700s, Prince Menshikov threw a party for Peter the Great, the Tsar who built this city. Peter loved dwarves. He was a lot like the Egyptians that way. He thought we were good luck, so he always kept some of us in his court. Anyway, Menshikov wanted to entertain the Tsar, so he thought it would be funny to stage a dwarf wedding. He forced us, to dress up, pretend to get married, and dance around. All the big folk were laughing, jeering.
His voice trailed off. Bess described the party like it was yesterday. Then I remembered that this weird little guy was a god. He'd been around for eons. Sadie put her hand on his shoulder.
I'm sorry, Bess. Must have been awful.
He scowled.
Russian magicians. They love capturing gods, using us. I can still hear that wedding music and the Tsar laughing.
How'd you get away? I asked. Bess glared at me. Obviously, I'd asked a bad question.
Enough of this. Bess turned up his collar. We're wasting time.
He forged ahead, but I got the feeling he wasn't really leaving Menshikov's palace behind. Suddenly, its cheery yellow walls and brightly lit windows looked sinister. Another 100 yards through the bitter wind, and we reached the bridge. On the other side, the Winter Palace shimmered.
I'll take the Mercedes the long way around, Bess said, down to the next bridge and circle south of the Hermitage. Less likely to alert the magicians that I'm here.
Now I realized why he was so paranoid about setting off alarms. Magicians had snared him in St. Petersburg once before. I remembered what he'd told us in the car. Don't get captured alive.
How do we find you if we succeed? Sadie asked.
When you succeed, Bess said. Think positive, girl, or the world ends.
Right.
Sadie shivered in her new parka.
Positive.
I'll meet you on the Nevsky Prospect, the main street with all the shops just south of the Hermitage. I'll be at the Chocolate Museum.
The what now? I asked.
Well, it's not really a museum, more of a shop. Closed this time of night, but the owner always opens up for me. They've got chocolate everything. Chess sets, lions, Vladimir Lenin heads.
The communist guy? I asked.
Yes, Professor Brilliant, Bess said. The communist guy, in chocolate.
So, let me get this straight, Sadie said. We break into a heavily guarded Russian National Museum, find the magician's secret headquarters, find a dangerous scroll, and escape. Meanwhile, you will be eating chocolate.
Bess nodded solemnly.
It's a good plan. It might work. If something happens and I can't meet you at the Chocolate Museum, our exit point is the Egyptian Bridge to the south at the Fontanka River. Just turn on the...
Enough! Sadie said. You will meet us at the chocolate shop, and you will provide me with a takeaway bag. That is final. Now go.
Bess gave her a lopsided smile.
You're okay, girl.
He trudged back toward the Mercedes. I looked across the half-frozen river to the Winter Palace. Somehow, London didn't seem as dreary or dangerous anymore.
Are we in as much trouble as I think? I asked Sadie.
More, she said.
Let's go crash the Tsar's palace, shall we?
10. An old red friend comes to visit. Getting inside the Hermitage wasn't a problem. State-of-the-art security doesn't protect against magic. Sadie and I had to combine forces to get past the perimeter, but with a little concentration, ink and papyrus, and some tapped energy from our godly friends Isis and Horus, we managed to pull off a short stroll through the Duat. 1 minute we were standing in the abandoned palace square, then everything went gray and misty. My stomach tingled like I was in free fall. We slipped out of sync with the mortal world and passed through the iron gates and solid stone into the museum. The Egyptian room was on the ground floor, just as Bess had said. We re-entered the mortal realm and found ourselves in the middle of the collection. Sarcophagi and glass cases, hieroglyphic scrolls, statues of gods and pharaohs. It wasn't much different from 100 other Egyptian collections I'd seen, but the setting was pretty impressive. A vaulted ceiling soared overhead. The polished marble floor was done in a white and gray diamond pattern, which made walking on it kind of like walking on an optical illusion. I wondered how many rooms there were like this in the Tsar's palace, and if it really took 11 days to see them all. I hoped Bess was right about the secret entrance to the gnome being somewhere in this room. We didn't have 11 days to search. In less than 72 hours, Apophis would break free. I remembered that glowing red eye beneath the scarab shells, a force of chaos so powerful it could melt human senses. 3 days, and that thing would be unleashed on the world. Sadie summoned her staff and pointed it at the nearest security camera. The lens cracked and made a sound like a bug zapper. Even in the best of situations, technology and magic don't get along. One of the easiest spells in the world is to make electronics malfunction. I just have to look at a cell phone funny to make it blow up. And computers? Forget about it. I imagined Sadie had just sent a magical pulse through the security system that would fry every camera and sensor in the network. Still, there were other kinds of surveillance, magical kinds. I pulled a piece of black linen and a pair of crude wax shapti out of my bag. I wrapped the shapti in the cloth and spoke a command word. Imun. The hieroglyph for hide glowed briefly over the cloth. A mass of darkness bloomed from the package, like a squid's ink cloud. It expanded until it covered both Sadie and me in a gauzy bubble of shadows. We could see through it, but hopefully nothing could see in. The cloud would be invisible to anyone outside.
"You got it right this time," Sadie said. "When did you master the spell?"
I probably blushed. I'd been obsessed with figuring out the invisibility spell for months, ever since I'd seen Zia use it in the first gnome. Well, actually, I'm still... A gold spark shot out of the cloud like a miniature fireworks rocket. I'm still working on it. Sadie sighed.
Well, better than last time. The cloud looked like a lava lamp, and the time before, when it smelled like rotten eggs, could we just get going? I asked. Where should we start?
Her eyes locked on one of the displays. She drifted toward it in a trance. Sadie? I followed her to a limestone grave marker, a stela, about 2 feet by 3 feet. The description next to it was in Russian and English. From the tomb of the scribe Ippi, I read aloud, worked in the court of King Tut. Why are you interested? Oh. Stupid me. The picture on the gravestone showed the deceased scribe honoring Anubis. After talking with Anubis in person, Sadie must have found it strange to see him in a 3,000-year-old tomb painting, especially when he was pictured with the head of a jackal, wearing a skirt. Walt likes you. I have no idea why I blurted that out. This wasn't the time or the place. I knew I wasn't doing Walt any favors by taking his side, but I'd started to feel bad for him after Bess kicked him out of the limo. The guy had come all the way to London to help me save Sadie, and we dumped him in Crystal Palace Park like an unwanted hitchhiker. I was kind of angry at Sadie for giving him the cold shoulder and crushing so hard on Anubis, who was 5,000 years too old for her and not even human. Plus, the way she snubbed Walt reminded me too much of the way Zia had treated me at first. And maybe, if I was honest with myself, I was also irritated with Sadie because she'd solved her own problems in London without needing our help.
Wow. That sounded really selfish. But I suppose it was true. Amazing how many different ways a younger sister can annoy you at once.
Sadie didn't take her eyes off the stela.
Carter, you have no idea what you're talking about.
You're not giving the guy a chance, I insisted. Whatever's going on with him, it's got nothing to do with you.
Very reassuring, but that's not... Besides, Anubis is a god. You don't honestly think... Carter!
She snapped. My cloaking spell must have been sensitive to emotion because another gold spark whistled and popped from our not-so-invisible cloud.
I wasn't looking at this stone because of Anubis.
You weren't?
No. And I'm certainly not having an argument with you about Walt. Contrary to what you might think, I don't spend every waking hour thinking about boys.
Just most waking hours? She rolled her eyes.
Look at the gravestone, bird brain. It's got a border around it, like a window frame or
a door, I said. It's a false door. Lots of tombs had those. It was like a symbolic gateway for the dead person's ba, so it could go back and forth from the duat. Sadie pulled her wand and traced the edges of the stela.
This bloke, Ippy, was a scribe, which was another word for magician. He could have been one of us.
So?
So maybe that's why the stone is glowing, Carter. What if this false door's not false?
I looked at the stela more closely, but I didn't see any glow. I thought maybe Sadie was hallucinating from exhaustion or too much potion in her system. Then she touched her wand to the center of the stela and spoke the first command word we'd ever learned.
Whippe!
Open. A golden hieroglyph burned on the stone. The grave marker shot out a beam of light like a movie projector. Suddenly, a full-size doorway shimmered in front of us, a rectangular portal showing the hazy image of another room. I looked at Sadie in amazement.
How did you do that?
Open. A golden hieroglyph burned on the stone. The grave marker shot out a beam of light like a movie projector. Suddenly, a full-size doorway shimmered in front of us, a rectangular portal showing the hazy image of another room. I looked at Sadie in amazement.
How did you do that?
I asked. You've never been able to do that before. She shrugged as if it were no big deal.
I wasn't 13 before. Maybe that's it.
But I'm 14, I protested,
and I still can't do that. Girls mature earlier.
I gritted my teeth. I hated the spring months. March, April, May, because until my birthday rolled around in June, Sadie could claim to be only a year younger than me. She always got an attitude after her birthday, as if she'd catch up to me somehow and become my big sister. Talk about a nightmare. She gestured at the glowing doorway.
After you, brother dear. You're the one with the sparkly invisibility cloud.
Before I could lose my cool, I stepped through the portal. I almost fell and broke my face. The other side of the portal was a mirror hanging 5 feet off the floor. I'd stepped onto a fireplace mantle. I caught Sadie as she came through, just in time to keep her from toppling off the ledge.
"Ta,"
she whispered.
"Someone's been reading too much Alice through the looking glass."
I thought the Egyptian room was impressive, but it was nothing compared to this ballroom. Coppery geometric designs glittered on the ceiling. The walls were lined with dark green columns and gilded doors. White and gold inlaid marble made a huge octagonal pattern on the floor. With a blazing chandelier above, the golden filigree and green and white polished stone gleamed so brightly they hurt my eyes. Then I realized most of the light wasn't coming from the chandelier. It was coming from the magician casting a spell at the other end of the room. His back was turned, but I could tell it was Vlad Menshikov. Just as Sadie had described, he was a pudgy little man with curly gray hair and a white suit. He stood in a protective circle that pulsed with emerald light. He raised his staff and the tip burned like a welding torch. To his right, just outside the circle, stood a green vase the size of a grown man. To his left, writhing in glowing chains, was a creature I recognized as a demon. It had a hairy humanoid body with purplish skin, but instead of a head, a giant corkscrew sprouted between its shoulders.
Mercy!
It screamed in a watery, metallic voice. Don't ask me how a demon could scream with a corkscrew head, but the sound resonated up the screw like it was a massive tuning fork. Vlad Menshikov kept chanting. The green vase throbbed with light. Sadie nudged me and whispered,
Look.
Yeah, I whispered back, some kind of summoning ritual.
No, she hissed. Look there.
She pointed to our right. In the corner of the room, 20 feet from the fireplace mantel, was an old-fashioned mahogany desk. Sadie had told me about Anubis's instructions. We were supposed to find Menshikov's desk. The next section of the Book of Ra would be in the middle drawer. Could that really be the desk? It seemed too easy. As quietly as we could, Sadie and I climbed off the mantel and crept along the wall. I prayed the invisibility shroud wouldn't send up any more fireworks. We were about halfway to the desk when Vlad Menshikov finished his chant. He slammed his staff against the floor, and it stuck there, straight up, the tip still burning at 1,000,000 degrees. He turned his head slightly, and I caught the glint of his white sunglasses. He rummaged in his coat pockets while the big green vase glowed, and the demon screamed in his chains.
Don't fuss death to corks,
Menshikov chided. His voice was even rougher than Sadie had described, like a heavy smoker talking through the blades of a fan.
You know I need a sacrifice to summon such a major god. It's nothing personal.
Sadie frowned at me and mouthed, Major God? I shook my head, baffled. The House of Life didn't allow mortals to summon gods. It was the main reason Desjardins hated us. Menshikov was supposedly his best bud, so what was he doing, breaking the rules?
Hurts, the poor demon wailed. Served you for 50 years, master. Please.
Now.
Menshikov said without a trace of sympathy.
I have to use execration. Only the most painful form of banishment will generate enough energy.
From his suit coat pocket, Menshikov pulled a regular corkscrew and a shard of pottery covered with red hieroglyphics. He held up both items and began to chant again.
I name you Death to Corks, servant of Vladimir, he who turns in the night.
As the demon's names were spoken, the magical chains steamed and tightened around his body. Menshikov held the corkscrew over the flame of his staff. The demon thrashed and wailed. As the smaller corkscrew turned red-hot, the demon's body began to smoke. I watched in horror. I knew about sympathetic magic, of course. The idea was to make something small affect something large by binding them together. The more alike the items were, like the corkscrew and the demon, the easier they were to bind. Voodoo dolls worked on the same theory. But execration was serious stuff. It meant destroying a creature utterly, erasing its physical form and even its name from existence. It took some serious magic to pull off that kind of spell. If done wrong, it could destroy the caster. But if done right, most victims didn't stand a chance. Regular mortals, magicians, ghosts, even demons could be wiped off the face of the earth. Execration might not destroy major powers like gods, but it would still be like detonating a nuclear bomb in their face. They'd be blasted so deep into the Duat, they might never come back. Vlad Menshikov worked the spell like he did it every day. He kept chanting as the corkscrew began to melt and the demon melted with it. Menshikov dropped the pottery shard on the floor, the red hieroglyphs that spelled all the demon's various names. With one final word of power, Menshikov stepped on the shard and crushed it to bits. Death to corks dissolved, chains and all. Usually I don't feel sorry for creatures of the underworld, but I couldn't help getting a lump in my throat. I couldn't believe the casual way Menshikov had snuffed out his servant just to power a larger spell. As soon as the demon was gone, the fire on Menshikov's staff died. Hieroglyphs burned around the summoning circle. The big green jar trembled, and a voice from deep inside boomed,
"Hello, Vladimir. Long time."
Sadie inhaled sharply. I had to cover her mouth to keep her from screaming. We both knew that voice. I remembered it all too well from the Red Pyramid.
"Set."
Menshikov didn't even look tired from the summoning. He sounded awfully calm for someone addressing the god of evil.
"We need to talk."
Sadie pushed my hand away and whispered,
"Is he mad?"
"Desk," I said. "Scroll. Out of here. Now." For once, she gave me no argument. She began fishing supplies out of her bag. Meanwhile, the big green jar wobbled as if Set were trying to tip it over.
"A malachite vase." The god sounded annoyed. "Really, Vladimir, I thought we were on friendlier terms than that."
Menshikov's laugh sounded like someone choking a cat.
"Excellent at constraining evil spirits, isn't it? And this room has more malachite than any other place on Earth. Empress Alexandra was quite wise to have it built for her drawing room."
The jar plinked.
"But it smells like old pennies in here, and it's much too cold. Have you ever been stuck in a malachite jar, Vlad? I'm not a genie. I'd be so much more talkative if we could sit face to face. Perhaps over tea."
"I'm afraid not," said Menshikov. "Now, you'll answer my questions."
"Oh, very well," Set said. "I like Brazil for the World Cup. I'd advise investing in platinum and small cap funds. And your lucky numbers this week are 2, 13.
"Not those questions,"
Menshikov snapped. Sadie pulled a lump of wax from her bag and worked furiously, fashioning some kind of animal shape. I knew she was going to test the desk for magic defenses. She was better at that kind of spell than I was, but I wasn't sure how she'd do it. Egyptian magic is pretty open-ended. There are always 1,000 different ways to accomplish a task. The trick is being creative with your supplies and picking a way that won't get you killed.
"You will tell me what I need to know,"
Menshikov demanded,
"or that jar will become even more uncomfortable."
"My dear Vladimir," Set's voice was full of evil amusement, "what you need to know may be very different from what you want to know. Didn't your unfortunate accident teach you that?"
Menshikov touched his sunglasses, as if making sure they hadn't fallen off.
"You will tell me the binding for Apophis,"
he said in a steely tone.
"Then you will tell me how to neutralize the enchantments on Brooklyn House. You know Kane's defenses better than anyone. Once I destroy him, I will have no opposition."
As the meaning of Menshikov's words sank in, a wave of rage nearly knocked me off my feet. This time, Sadie had to clamp my mouth shut.
"Calm," she whispered. "You're going to start the invisibility shield popping again."
I pushed her hand away and hissed,
"But he wants to free Apophis. I know. And attack Amos. I know. So help me get the bloody scroll and let's get out of here."
She put her wax animal on the desk, a dog, I thought, and began writing hieroglyphs on its back with a stylus. I took a shaky breath. Sadie was right, but still, Menshikov was talking about freeing Apophis and killing our uncle. What kind of magician makes deals with Set? Except for Sadie and me. That was different.
Set's laugh echoed inside the green vase.
So, the binding for Apophis and the secrets of Brooklyn House. Is that all, Vladimir? I wonder what your master Desjardins would think if he found out your real plan and the sort of friends you keep.
Menshikov snatched up his staff. The carved serpent tip flared again.
Be careful with your threats, evil day.
The jar trembled. Throughout the room, glass cases shivered. The chandelier jangled like a 3-ton wind chime. I gave Sadie a panicked look. Did he just...
Set secret name, she confirmed,
still writing on her wax dog.
How... I don't know, Carter. Now shh.
A god's secret name had all kinds of power. It was supposed to be almost impossible to get. To truly learn it, you couldn't just hear it repeated by some random person. You had to hear it straight from the god himself or from the person closest to his heart. Once you had it, it gave you serious magical leverage over that god. Sadie had learned Set's secret name during our quest last Christmas, but how had Menshikov gotten it? Inside the jar, Set growled with annoyance.
I really hate that name. Why couldn't it have been Glorious Day or the Rockin' Red Reaper? That's rather nice. Bad enough when you were the only one who knew it, Vlad. Now I've got the Cane Girl to worry about.
Serve us,
Menshikov said,
and the Canes will be destroyed. You will be the honored lieutenant of Apophis. You can raise another temple, even grander than the Red Pyramid.
Aha, Set said. Maybe you haven't noticed, but I don't do well with the whole second-in-command concept. As for Apophis, he's not one to suffer other gods getting attention.
We will free Apophis with or without your help,
Menshikov warned.
By the equinox, he will rise. But if you help us make that happen sooner, you will be rewarded. Your other option is execration. Oh, I know it won't destroy you completely, but with your secret name, I can send you into the abyss for eons, and it will be very, very painful. I'll give you 30 seconds to decide.
I nudged Sadie. Hurry! She tapped the wax dog, and it came to life. It started sniffing around the desk, looking for magic traps. Inside the jar, Set sighed.
Well, Vladimir, you do know how to make an appealing offer. The binding for Apophis, you say? Yes. I was there when Ra cast the serpent into that prison of scarabs. I suppose I could remember the ingredients he used for the binding. Quite a day that was. I was wearing red, I think. At the victory feast, they served the most delicious honey-baked locusts.
You have 10 seconds,
Menshikov said.
Oh, I'll cooperate. I hope you have a pen and paper handy. It's a rather long list of ingredients. Let's see. What did Ra use for a base?
Bat dung?
Then there were the dried toads, of course. And then...
Set began rattling off ingredients while Sadie's wax dog sniffed around the desk. Finally, it lay down on the blotter and went to sleep. Sadie frowned at me.
No traps.
That's too easy, I whispered back. She opened the top drawer. there was the papyrus scroll, just like the one we'd found in Brooklyn. She slipped it into her bag. We were halfway back to the fireplace when Set caught us by surprise. He was going on with his list of ridiculous ingredients.
And snake skins, yes, 3 large ones, with a sprinkling of hot sauce.
Then he stopped abruptly, like he'd had a revelation. He spoke in a much louder voice, calling across the room.
And a sacrificial victim would be good. Maybe a young idiot magician who can't do a proper invisibility spell, like Carter Kane over there.
I froze. Vladimir Menshikov turned, and my panic became too much for the invisibility shroud. 6 golden sparks shot up with a loud, happy whee! The cloud of darkness dissolved. Menshikov stared right at me.
My, my, how kind of you to deliver yourselves. Well done, Set.
Hmm, Set asked innocently. Do we have visitors?
Set, Sadie growled. I'll kick you in the bar for that, so help me.
The voice in the jar gasped.
Sadie Kane, how exciting. Too bad I'm stuck in this jar, and no one will let me out.
The hint wasn't too subtle, but surely he couldn't believe we'd free him after he'd blown our cover. Sadie faced Menshikov, her wand and staff ready.
You're working with Apophis. You're on the wrong side.
Menshikov removed his glasses. His eyes were ruined pits of scar tissue, burned skin, and glistening corneas. Believe me, that is the least gross way I can describe them.
The wrong side, Menshikov asked. Girl, you have no idea the powers that are in play. 5,000 years ago, Egyptian priests prophesied how the world would end. Ra would grow old and tired, and Apophis would swallow him and plunge the world into darkness. Chaos would rule forever. Now the time is here. You can't stop it. You can only choose whether you'll be destroyed or whether you'll bow to the power of chaos and survive.
Right, Set chimed in. It's too bad I'm stuck in this jar. Otherwise, I might have to take sides and help someone.
Shut up, Set! Menshikov snapped. No one is crazy enough to trust you. And as for you children, you are clearly not the threat I imagined.
Great, I said. So we can go? Menshikov laughed.
Would you run to Desjardins and tell him what you've heard? He wouldn't believe you. He'd put you on trial, then execute you. But I'll spare you that embarrassment. I'll kill you right now.
How fun, Set said. Wish I could see it, but I'm stuck in this jar.
I tried to think. Menshikov was still inside a protective circle, which meant he had a big defensive advantage. I wasn't sure I could bust through it, even if I could summon a combat avatar. Meanwhile, Menshikov could take his time trying out different ways to destroy us. Would he blast us with elemental magic? Change us into bugs? He threw his staff to the ground, and I cursed. Throwing down your staff may sound like a sign of surrender, but in Egyptian magic, it's bad news. It usually means, hey, I'm going to summon a big nasty thing to kill you while I stand safely inside my circle and laugh. Sure enough, Menshikov's staff began to writhe and grow. Great, I thought, another serpent. But something was wrong with this one. Instead of a tail, it had a head on both ends. At first I thought we'd caught some luck, and Menshikov had summoned a monster with a rare genetic birth defect.
Then the thing sprouted 4 dragon legs. Its body grew until it was the size of a draft horse, curved like a U, with mottled red and green scales and a rattlesnake head on either side. It reminded me of that 2-headed animal from Dr. Doolittle. You know, the push-me-pull-you? Except Dr. Doolittle would never have wanted to talk to this thing, and if he had, it would probably have just said, "Hello, I'm going to eat you." Both heads turned toward us and hissed. "I've really had enough snakes for 1 week," I muttered. Menshikov smiled.
"But serpents are my specialty, Carter Kane."
He touched a silver pendant hanging over his necktie, an amulet shaped like a snake.
"And this particular creature is my favorite, the Chesu Hiru. 2 hungry mouths to feed, 2 troublesome children. Perfect."
Sadie and I looked at each other. We had one of those moments where we could read each other's expressions perfectly. We both knew we couldn't defeat Menshikov. He'd let the push-me-pull-you snake wear us down, and if we survived that, he'd just blast us with something else. The guy was a pro. We would either die or get captured, and Bess had warned us about not getting taken alive. After seeing what had happened to that demon Death to Corks, I took Bess's warning seriously. To survive, we'd have to do something crazy, something so suicidal Menshikov would never expect it. We had to get help immediately. "Should I?" Sadie asked.
"Do it," I agreed.
The Chesu Hiru bared its dripping fangs. You wouldn't think a creature with no back end could move so fast, but it bent both heads toward us like a giant horseshoe and charged. I pulled my sword. Sadie was faster. She pointed her staff at Set's malachite jar and yelled her favorite command word.
"Hadi!"
I was afraid it wouldn't work. She hadn't tried the destruction spell since she separated herself from Isis. But just before the monster reached me, the green jar shattered. Menshikov screamed,
"Nyet!"
A sandstorm exploded through the room. Hot winds pushed Sadie and me against the fireplace. A wall of red sand slammed into the Chesu Hiru and sent it flying sideways into a malachite column. Vlad Menshikov was blasted right out of his protective circle and banged his head on a table. He crumpled to the ground, red sand swirling over him until he was completely buried. When the storm cleared, a man in a red silk suit stood in front of us. He had skin the color of cherry Kool-Aid, a shaved head, a dark goatee, and glittering black eyes lined with coal. He looked like an Egyptian devil ready for a night on the town. He grinned and spread his hands in a ta-da gesture.
"That's better. Thank you, Sadie Kane."
To our left, the Chesu Hiru hissed and flailed, trying to get back on its feet. The pile of red sand covering Vlad Menshikov started to move.
"Do something, evil day," Sadie commanded. "Get rid of them."
Set winced.
"No need to get personal with the names."
"Maybe you'd prefer Rockin' Red Reaper?" I asked. Set made a picture frame with his fingers, as if imagining that name on his driver's license.
"Yes, that is nice, isn't it?"
The Chesu Hiru staggered to its feet. It shook both heads and glared at us, but it seemed to ignore Set, even though he was the one who'd slammed it against the wall.
"It has beautiful coloration, doesn't it?"
Set asked.
"A gorgeous specimen."
"Just kill it," I yelled.
Set looked shocked.
"Oh, I couldn't do that. I'm much too fond of snakes. Besides, Getem would have my hide."
"Getem?" I asked.
"Gods for the ethical treatment of monsters."
"You're making that up," I yelled.
Set grinned.
"Still, I'm afraid you'll have to deal with the Chesu Hiru on your own."
The monster hissed at us, which probably meant,
"Sweet!"
I raised my sword to keep it at bay.
The pile of red sand shifted. Menshikov's dazed face rose from the top. Set snapped his fingers and a large ceramic pot appeared in the air, shattering on the magician's head. Menshikov slipped back into the sand.
"I'll stay here and entertain Vladimir," Set said.
"Can't you execrate him or something?" Sadie demanded.
"Oh, I wish. Unfortunately, I'm rather limited when someone holds my secret name, especially when they've given me specific orders not to kill them."
He stared accusingly at Sadie.
"At any rate, I may be able to buy you a few minutes, but Vlad is going to be quite mad when he comes around, so I'd hurry if I were you. Good luck surviving, and good luck eating them, Chesuhiru."
I wanted to strangle Set, but we had bigger problems. As if encouraged by Set's pep talk, the Chesuhiru lunged at us. Sadie and I sprinted for the nearest door. We ran through the Winter Palace with Set's laughter echoing behind us.
11. Carter does something incredibly stupid, and no one is surprised. "I understand, Carter, I do. Have me narrate the most painful part. Of course, I can't blame you. What happened was awful enough for me, but for you, well, I wouldn't want to talk about it either. There we were in the Winter Palace, racing down polished marble hallways that were not designed for running. Behind us, the two-headed Chesuhiru skidded and slammed into walls as it tried to turn corners, much like Muffin used to do whenever Gran mopped the floor. That's the only reason the monster didn't catch us immediately. Since we'd teleported into the Malachite room, I had no idea where the nearest exit was. I wasn't even sure if we were actually in the Winter Palace, or if Menshikov's office was some clever facsimile that existed only in the Duat. I was beginning to think we'd never get out, when we rounded a corner, scrambled down a staircase, and spotted a set of glass and iron doors leading out to Palace Square. The Chesuhiru was right behind us. It slipped and rolled down the staircase, demolishing a plaster statue of some unfortunate Tsar. We were 10 meters from the exit when I saw the chains across the doors. "Carter!" I gasped, waving helplessly at the padlock. I hate to admit just how weak I felt. I didn't have the strength for another spell. Cracking Set's vase in the Malachite room had been my last hurrah, which is a good example of why you shouldn't use magic to solve all your problems. Summoning a divine word to break the vase had taken so much energy, I felt as if I'd been digging holes in the hot sun. It would have been much easier just to throw a rock. If I lived through the night, I decided to add some rocks to my tool bag. We were 3 meters away when Carter thrust his fist toward the doors. The Eye of Horus burned against the padlock, and the doors burst open as if they'd been hit by a giant fist. I hadn't seen Carter do anything like that since our fight at the Red Pyramid, but I didn't have time to be amazed. We bolted outside into the wintry night, the Chesuhiru roaring behind us. You'll think I was mad, but my first thought was, that was too easy. Despite the monster chasing us and the business with Set, whom I would strangle at the first opportunity, that backstabbing git, I couldn't help feeling we'd breached Menshikov's inner sanctum and snatched the scroll without nearly enough trouble. Where were the traps, the alarms, the exploding donkey curses? I was certain we'd stolen the authentic scroll. I'd felt the same tingle in my fingers as when I'd taken the one from the Brooklyn Museum. Without the fire, thankfully, so why hadn't the scroll been better protected? I was so tired, I fell a few steps behind Carter, which probably saved my life. I felt a crawling sensation across my scalp. I sensed darkness above me, a feeling that reminded me too much of the shadow of Nekvet's wings. I looked up and saw the Chesuhiru sailing over our heads like a massive bullfrog, timing its pounce so it would land... "Carter, stop!" I yelled. Easier said than done on icy pavement. I skidded to a halt, but Carter was going too fast. He fell on his bum and slid, his sword skittering to one side. The Chesuhiru landed right on top of him. If it hadn't been U-shaped, Carter would have been crushed, but it curved around him like an enormous pair of headphones, one head glaring down at him from either side. How could something so large have leapt so far? Too late, I realized we should have stayed inside where it was harder for the monster to move. Out here, we had no chance of outrunning it. Carter, I said, stay perfectly still. He froze in crab walk position. The monster's two heads dripped venom that hissed and steamed on the icy stones. Oi! I yelled. Not having any rocks, I picked up a chunk of broken ice and threw it at the Jesuhiru. Naturally, I hit Carter in the back instead. Nevertheless, I got the Jesuhiru's attention. Both heads turned toward me, twin tongues flickering. First step done, distract the monster. Second step, find some clever way to draw it away from Carter. That part was giving me a bit more trouble. I'd used my only potion, most of my magic supplies were gone, my staff and wand wouldn't do me much good with my magical reserves drained, the knife from Anubis, somehow I doubted this was the right situation to open someone's mouth, the amulet from Walt, I had not the slightest idea how to use it. For the millionth time, I regretted having given up the spirit of Isis. I could really have used the full magic arsenal of a goddess, but, of course, that was exactly why I'd had to separate from her. That sort of power is intoxicating, dangerously addictive. It can quickly destroy your life. But what if I could form a limited bond? In the Malachite room, I'd managed the Hardy spell for the first time in months, and while it had been difficult, it hadn't been impossible. Right, Isis, I thought, here's what I need. Don't think, Sadie, her voice whispered back almost immediately, which was quite a shock. Divine magic has to be involuntary, like breathing. You mean, I stopped myself, don't think. Well, that shouldn't be too hard. I held up my staff and a golden hieroglyph blazed in the air. A 1-meter-tall Ta'it lit up the courtyard like a Christmas tree star. The Jesuhiru snarled, its yellow eyes fixed on the hieroglyph. Don't like that, eh? I called. Symbol of Isis, you big ugly mutt! Now get away from my brother! It was a complete bluff, of course. I doubted the glowing sign could do anything useful, but I hoped the snake creature wasn't smart enough to know that. Slowly, Carter edged backward. He looked for his sword, but it was 10 meters away, much too far to reach. I kept my eyes on the monster. I used the butt of my staff to trace a magic circle in the snow around me. It wouldn't provide much protection, but it was better than nothing. Carter, I called, when I say go, run back here. That thing's too fast, he said. I'll try to detonate the hieroglyph and blind it. I still maintain that the plan would have worked, but I didn't get the chance to try it. Somewhere off to my left, boots crunched on ice. The monster turned toward the sound. A young man ran into the light of the hieroglyph. He was dressed in a heavy wool coat and a policeman's hat, with a rifle in his hands, but he couldn't have been much older than me. He was fairly drowning in his uniform. When he saw the monster, his eyes widened. He stumbled backward, almost dropping his weapon. He yelled something at me in Russian, probably, "Why is there a two-headed snake monster with no bum?" The monster hissed at both of us, which it could do, having two heads. "That's a monster," I told the guard. I was fairly sure he couldn't understand, but I tried to keep my tone steady. "Stay calm and don't shoot. I'm trying to save my brother." The guard swallowed. His large ears were the only things holding up his hat. He glanced from the monster to Carter to the Ta'it glowing above my head. Then he did something I wasn't expecting. He said a word in ancient Egyptian, Hekat, the command I always used to summon my staff. His rifle changed to a 2-meter oaken rod with the carved head of a falcon. Wonderful, I thought. The security guards are secretly magicians. He addressed me in Russian, some sort of warning. I recognized the name Menshikov. Let me guess, I said. You want to take me to your leader? The Jesuhiru snapped its jaws. It was rapidly losing its fear of my glowing Ta'it. Carter wasn't far enough away to make a run for it. Look, I told the guard, your boss Menshikov is a traitor. He summoned this thing to kill us so we wouldn't blab about his plans to free Apophis. Savvy the word Apophis? Bad snake. Very bad snake. Now, either help me kill this monster or stay out of my way. The magician guard hesitated. He pointed at me nervously.
Cain.
It wasn't a question. Yes, I agreed. Cain. His expression was a jumble of emotions. Fear, disbelief, possibly even awe. I didn't know what he'd heard about us, but before he could decide whether to help us or fight us, the situation spun out of control. The Jesuhiru charged. My ridiculous brother, instead of rolling out of the way, tackled the monster. He locked his arms around the creature's right neck and tried to climb its back, but the Jesuhiru simply turned its other head to strike. What was my brother thinking? Perhaps he thought he could ride the beast. Perhaps he was trying to buy me a few seconds to cast a spell. If you ask him about it now, he'll claim he doesn't remember the incident at all. But if you ask me, the thick-headed fool was trying to save me, even if it meant sacrificing himself. The nerve! Oh, yes. Now you try to explain yourself, Carter. I thought you didn't remember this bit. Just be quiet and let me tell the story. As I was saying, the Jesuhiro struck at Carter, and everything seemed to slow down. I remember screaming, lowering my staff at the monster. The soldier magician yelled something in Russian. The creature sank its fangs into Carter's left shoulder, and he dropped to the ground. I forgot about my makeshift circle. I ran toward him, and my staff glowed. I don't know how I managed the power. As Isis said, I didn't think. I simply channeled all my rage and shock into my staff. Seeing Carter hurt was the final insult. My grandparents had been possessed, my friends had been attacked, and my birthday ruined. But my brother was off limits. No one was allowed to hurt my brother. I unleashed a beam of golden light that hit the monster with the force of a sandblaster. The Jesuhiru crumpled to bits until there was nothing left but a streak of sand steaming in the snow and a few splinters of Menshikov's shattered staff. I ran to Carter's side. He was shivering. His eyes rolled back in his head. Two puncture wounds in his coat were smoking. Cain, the young Russian said with a tone of awe. I snatched up a splinter of wood and held it for him to see. Your boss Menshikov did this. He's working for Apophis. Menshikov, Apophis. Now get out! The magician may not have understood my words, but he got the message. He turned and ran. I cradled Carter's head. I couldn't carry him by myself, but I had to get him out of here. We were in enemy territory. I needed to find Bess. I struggled to get him to his feet. Then someone took Carter's other arm and helped us up. I found Set grinning at me, still in his ridiculous red disco suit, dusted with malachite rubble. Menshikov's broken white sunglasses were propped on his head. You, I said, too filled with loathing to issue a proper death threat. Me, Set agreed cheerily. Let's get your brother out of here, shall we? Vladimir is not in a good mood. The Nevsky Prospect would have been a lovely place to shop if it hadn't been the wee hours of the morning during a snowstorm, and if I hadn't been carrying my poisoned comatose brother. The street had wide pavements, perfect for strolling, lined with a dazzling assortment of high-end boutiques, cafes, churches, and mansions. With all the signs in Russian, I didn't see how I was going to find the chocolate shop. I couldn't spot Bess's black Mercedes anywhere. Set volunteered to carry Carter, but I wasn't about to let the god of chaos take full charge of my brother, so we dragged him between us. Set chatted amiably about the Jesuhiru poison.
Completely incurable, fatal in about 12 hours. It's amazing stuff.
And his tussle with Menshikov.
6 vases broken over his head, and he still survives. I envy his thick skull.
And my prospects of living long enough to find Bess.
Oh, you're toast, my dear. 12 senior magicians were rallying to Menshikov when I made my, strategic retreat. They'll be after you shortly. I could have destroyed them all, of course, but I couldn't risk Vladimir using my secret name again. Maybe he'll get amnesia and forget it. Then, if you die, that would be both problems solved. Oh, I'm sorry, I suppose that sounded insensitive. Come along.
Carter's head lolled. His breathing sounded almost as bad as Vlad the Inhaler's. Now, please, don't think I was dense. Of course I remembered the wax Minnie Carter figurine Jazz had given me. I recognized that this was just the sort of emergency where it might come in handy. How Jazz had predicted Carter would need healing, I had no idea. But it was possible the figurine could draw the poison out of him, despite what Set said about it being incurable. What does a god of evil know about healing, anyway? There were problems, however. First, I knew very little about healing magic. I needed time to figure out the proper casting, and since I had only one wax statue, I couldn't afford to get it wrong. Second, I couldn't very well do that while being chased by Menshikov and his squad of magical Russian goons, nor did I want to let my guard down with Set anywhere near me. I didn't know why he'd decided to be helpful all of a sudden, but the sooner I could lose him, the better. I needed to find Bess and retreat to somewhere safe, if there was such a place. Set kept chatting about all the exciting ways the magicians might kill me once they caught up. Finally, I spotted a bridge up ahead over a frozen canal. Parked in the middle was the black Mercedes. Bess leaned against the hood, eating pieces off a chocolate chessboard. Next to him sat a large plastic bag, hopefully with more chocolate for me. I yelled to him, but he was so engrossed in eating chocolate, which I suppose I could understand, that he didn't notice us until we were a few meters away. Then he looked up and saw Set. I started to say, "Bess, don't..." Too late. Like a skunk, the dwarf god activated his default defense. His eyes bulged out, his mouth opened impossibly wide. He yelled, "Boo!" so loudly my hair parted and icicles rained down from the bridge's street lamps. Set didn't look the least bit fazed. "Hello, Bess," he said. "Really, you're not so scary with chocolate smeared on your face." Bess glared at me.
"What's he doing here?"
"Not my idea," I promised. I gave him the abbreviated story of our encounter with Menshikov. "And so Carter's been hurt," I summed up, which seemed rather obvious. "We have to get him out of here."
"But first,"
Set interrupted, pointing at the chocolate museum bag next to Bess.
"I can't stand surprises. What's in there? A gift for me?"
Bess frowned.
"Sadie wanted a souvenir. I brought her Lenin's head."
Set slapped his thigh with delight.
"Bess, how evil. There's hope for you yet." "Not his real head," Bess said. "It's chocolate." "Oh, shame. Can I have part of your chessboard, then? I simply love eating pawns." "Get out of here, Set," Bess said. "Well, I could do that, but since our friends are on their way, I thought perhaps we should make a deal."
Set snapped his fingers and a globe of red light appeared in front of him. In it, the holographic images of six men in security uniforms piled into two white sports cars. Their headlights blazed to life. The cars swerved across a parking lot, then passed straight through a stone wall as if it were made of smoke.
"I'd say you have about 2 minutes."
Set smiled, and the globe of light faded.
"You remember Menshikov's minions, Bess? Are you sure you want to meet them again?"
The dwarf god's face darkened. He crushed a white chocolate chess piece in his hand.
"You lying, scheming, murdering—"
"Stop!" I said. Carter groaned in his poisoned daze. Either he was getting heavier, or I was getting tired of holding him up. "We don't have time to argue," I said. "Set, are you offering to stop the magicians?" He laughed.
"No, no. I'm still hoping they'll kill you, you see. But I was going to offer you the location of the last scroll in the Book of Ra. That is what you're after, isn't it?"
I assumed he was lying. He usually was. But if he was serious... I looked at Bess. "Is it possible he knows the location?" Bess grunted.
"More than possible. The priests of Ra gave him the scroll for safekeeping."
"Why on earth would they do that?" Set tried to look modest.
Come now, Sadie. I was a loyal lieutenant of Ra. If you were Ra and you didn't want to be bothered by any old magician trying to wake you, wouldn't you trust the key to your location with your most fearsome servant?
He had a point. Where's the scroll, then?
Not so fast. I'll give you the location if you give me back my secret name.
Not likely!
It's quite simple. Just say, I give you back your name. You'll forget the proper way to say it.
And then I'll have no power over you. You'll kill me.
You'd have my word that I won't.
Right, that's worth a lot. What if I used your secret name to force you to tell me? Set shrugged.
With a few days to research the correct spell, you might manage that. Unfortunately...
He cupped his ear to his hand. In the distance, tires squealed. Two cars, travelling fast, getting closer.
You don't have a few days.
Bess cursed an Egyptian. Don't do it, girl. He can't be trusted. Can we find the scroll without him?
Well, maybe. Probably not. No.
The headlights of two cars swerved onto the Nevsky Prospect, roughly half a mile away. We were out of time. I had to get Carter away from here, but if Set really was our only way of finding the scroll, I couldn't just let him go. All right, Set, but I'll give you one last order.
Bess sighed. I can't bear to watch this. Give me your brother. I'll put him in the car.
The dwarf took Carter and stuffed him into the back seat of the Mercedes. I kept my eyes on Set, trying to think of the least terrible way to make this deal. I couldn't simply tell him to never hurt my family. A magical pact needed to be carefully worded with clear limits and an expiration date, or the whole spell would unravel. Evil Day, you are not to harm the Kane family. You'll maintain a truce with us at least until... Until Ra has been awakened.
Or until you try and fail to awaken him?
Set asked innocently. If that happens, I said, the world is going to end. So why not? I will do what you ask concerning your name. In exchange, you will tell me the location of the last part of the Book of Ra without trickery or deception. Then you'll depart for the Duat. Set considered the offer. The two white sports cars were only a few blocks away now. Bess shut Carter's door and ran back over.
We have a deal,
Set agreed.
You'll find the scroll at Baharia. Bess knows the place, I mean.
Bess didn't look happy.
That place is heavily protected. We'll have to use the Alexandria portal.
Yes, Set grinned. Should be interesting. How long can you hold your breath, Sadie Kane?
What do you mean?
Never mind, never mind. Now, I believe you owe me a secret name.
I give you back your name, I said. Just like that, I felt the magic leave me. I still knew Set's name, Evil Day. But somehow I couldn't remember exactly how I used to say it, or how it worked in a spell. The memory had been erased. To my surprise, Set didn't kill me on the spot. He just smiled and tossed me Vlad Menshikov's sunglasses.
I hope you live after all, Sadie Kane. You're quite amusing. But if they do kill you, at least enjoy the experience.
Gosh, thanks.
And just because I like you so much, I have a free piece of information for your brother. Tell him Zia Rashid's village was called Al-Hamra Makan.
Why is that?
Happy travels.
Set disappeared in a cloud of blood-colored mist. A block away, the two white sports cars barreled toward us. A magician stuck his head out of the sunroof of the lead car and pointed his staff in our direction.
Time to leave, Bess said. Get in.
I will say this for Bess. He drove like a maniac, and I mean that in the best possible way. Icy streets didn't bother him at all. Neither did traffic signals, pedestrian pavements, or canals, which he twice jumped without bothering to find a bridge. Fortunately, the city was mostly empty that time of morning, or I'm sure we would have mowed down any number of Russians. We wove through central St. Petersburg while the two white sports cars closed behind us. I tried to hold Carter steady next to me in the back seat. His eyes were half open, his corneas the most awful shade of green. Despite the cold, he was burning with fever. I managed to tug off his winter coat and found his shirt soaked with sweat. On his shoulder, the puncture wounds were oozing like... Well, it's probably best I don't describe that part. I glanced behind us. The magician in the sunroof aimed his staff, not an easy task in a high-speed car chase, and a glowing white javelin shot from the tip, hurtling toward us like a homing missile. "Duck!" I yelled, and pushed Carter against the seat. The javelin broke the rear window and flew straight through the windshield. If Bess had been normal height, he would have gotten a free head piercing. As it was, the projectile missed him completely.
"I'm a dwarf," he grumbled. "I don't duck."
He swerved to the right. Behind us, a storefront exploded. Looking back, I saw the entire wall dissolve into a pile of living snakes. Our pursuers were still closing. "Bess, get us out of here," I yelled.
"I'm trying, kid. Egyptian Bridge is coming up. It was originally built in the 1800s, but I don't care. Just drive."
Truly, it's amazing how many Egyptian bits and bobs there are in St. Petersburg, and how little I cared about them. Being chased by evil magicians throwing javelins and snake bombs does tend to clarify one's priorities. Suffice it to say, yes, there really is an Egyptian bridge over the Fontanka River leading south out of central St. Petersburg. Why? No idea. Don't care. As we raced toward it, I saw black stone sphinxes on either side, ladies' sphinxes with gilded pharaoh crowns, but the only thing that mattered to me was that they could summon a portal. Bess barked something in Egyptian. At the top of the bridge, blue light flashed. A swirling sand vortex appeared. "What did Set mean?" I asked, about holding my breath.
"Hopefully it won't be for long," Bess said. "We'll only be 30 feet under."
30 feet under water?! Bang! The Mercedes careened sideways. Only later did I realize another javelin must have hit our back tire. We spun across the ice and flipped, sliding upside down into the vortex. My head slammed against something. I opened my eyes, fighting for consciousness, but either I was blind or we were in complete darkness. I heard water trickling through the javelin-shattered glass and the roof of the Mercedes crumpling like an aluminum can. I had time to think, a teenager for less than a day and I'm going to drown. Then I blacked out. 12. I master the fine art of name-calling. It's disturbing to wake up as a chicken. My bar floated through dark water. My glowing wings flapped as I tried to figure out which way was up. I assumed my body was somewhere close by, possibly already drowned in the back of the Mercedes, but I couldn't figure out how to return to it. Why on earth had Bess driven us through an underwater portal? I hoped poor Carter had somehow survived. Perhaps Bess was able to pull him free. But dying from poison rather than drowning didn't seem much of an improvement. A current caught me and whisked me into the Duat. The water changed into cold fog. Wailing and growling filled the darkness. My acceleration slowed, and when the mist dissipated, I was back in Brooklyn House, floating just outside the infirmary door. On a bench against the wall, sitting together like old friends, were Anubis and Walt Stone. They looked like they were waiting for bad news. Walt's hands were folded in his lap, his shoulders slumped. He'd changed clothes, a new sleeveless tee, a new pair of running shorts, but he looked like he hadn't slept since returning from London. Anubis talked to him in soothing tones, as if trying to ease his grief. I'd never seen Anubis in traditional Egyptian clothes before. Bare-chested, with a golden ruby collar around his neck, a simple black kilt wrapped around his waist. It wasn't a look I'd recommend for most guys, but Anubis pulled it off. I'd always imagined he would look rather skinny with his shirt off. Not that I'd imagined that a lot, mind you, but he was in excellent shape. They must have had quite a good gym in the underworld, bench-pressing tombstones and whatnot. At any rate, after the shock of seeing them together, my first thought was that something terrible must have happened to Jazz. "What is it?" I asked, not sure if they could hear me. "What's happened?" Walt didn't react, but Anubis looked up. As usual, my heart did a little happy dance without my permission. His eyes were so mesmerizing I completely forgot how to use my brain. I said, I know Liz would have been proud.
"Sadie," Anubis said, "you shouldn't be here. Carter is dying."
That jarred me back to my senses. "I know that, Jackal boy. I didn't ask to be... Wait, why am I here?" Anubis pointed at the door of the infirmary.
"I suspect Jazzy's spirit called to you."
"Is she dead? Am I dead?"
"Neither," Anubis said. "But you are both on death's doorstep, which means your souls can speak to each other quite easily. Just don't stay long."
Walt still hadn't acknowledged me. He muttered,
"Couldn't tell her. Why couldn't I tell her?"
He opened his hands. Cradled in his palms was a golden Shen amulet exactly like the one he'd given me.